Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to early release and ad-free episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Videos of our Thursday release episodes between the madness are available on YouTube and Spotify. We've got all the links in our episode notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
In 1765, the English jurist William Blackstone wrote that it is better than 10 guilty persons escape than that one innocent suffer. The concept would come to be known as Blackstone's ratio, but it wasn't a new idea. Instead, Blackstone was distilling centuries of legal philosophy into a single, elegant principle, one that's defined our legal system's burden of proof ever since. 5 years later, the phrase, reasonable doubt, was first used during jury instructions at the Boston Massacre trials of 1770. Since then, it's become the bedrock of our entire judicial system. And on its face, the idea feels not just reasonable, but moral. Better to let some guilty person walk free than risk condemning a person who doesn't deserve it. While most people intuitively agree with this idea, it only addresses one half of the moral equation. But what happens if the guilty person who escaped is still a danger to society? Because all too often, it's the innocent who must bear the consequences. In Kansas City, a case spanning 2 decades would lay bare that cost in devastating fashion. A case that connects a missing person's mystery to a decapitated cat, and ultimately, to be a deadly massacre on a quiet suburban cul-de-sac, all bound together by a single name, and somewhere in the middle of it, a jury who made a decision they had every legal right to make, but one that would haunt the city long after the courtroom emptied. Join me now as we examine the Woodbridge Lane Massacre, one of the darkest chapters in Kansas City's history. You'll hear how a missing persons case in 1998 unraveled into something far more sinister, a trail of violence spanning 16 years. On the night of April 27, 1998, a group of teenagers gathered at the Cedar Tree apartment complex in Shawnee, Kansas, a suburb just southwest of Kansas City. Among them were 16-year-old Tabitha Brewer and 18-year-old Nicholas Travis. They'd been dating for more than a year and appeared inseparable. Both attended the same alternative high school, and Nicholas had moved into the apartment Tabitha shared with her father, Tom. Tabitha worked as a secretary at a mortgage company, and Nicholas picked up construction work whenever he could. They'd done well in school, stayed out of trouble, and were making plans for the future. According to Tabitha's mom, her daughter talked openly about marriage, children, and a life with Nicholas. Nothing about that night suggested those plans were about to end. Later in the evening, Nicholas told his friends he was expecting a ride. A fellow classmate from their alternative school was coming to pick him up for some kind of errand. He wouldn't say what it was, and his friends didn't really know the other student well. When the headlights swept across the parking lot, Nicholas stood up to leave. Whatever he had planned, he wanted to do it alone. But Tabitha wasn't having it. Tabitha argued with Nicholas until he relented and agreed to let her come too. Nobody was really surprised by this, because wherever he went, she went too, and vice versa. Just before midnight, the two of them climbed into their classmate's car as the friends watched the taillights disappear. That night, Nicholas and Tabitha never returned to her father's apartment, and they didn't come home the next day either. That's when Tabitha's father and stepmother decided it was time to file a missing persons report. But the police didn't take the report all that seriously, at least not at first. Initially, investigators believed it was a classic case of two runaway lovebirds, a popular Hollywood trope throughout the 90s. Police assumed they'd simply run off somewhere together and didn't think there was much to worry about. But their parents were adamant that neither teenager had any reason to run away. Both families had been in support of the couple's relationship, and everyone got along. Combined with the complete lack of motive for running away, there was also plenty of evidence to suggest they hadn't. For starters, Nicholas had his own car, but he left it at the apartment parking lot with half a tank of gas. Neither teen had packed anything either. Everything they owned was right where they left it, as though they planned to be gone for a few minutes, not a lifetime. Nicholas also had a paycheck waiting at work he never collected, and his bank account hadn't been touched since they disappeared. If these two were runaways, it meant they'd gone on the run without a car, without money, clothes, and without telling a soul where they were going. 3 days after the couple vanished, a witness on the south side of Kansas City saw a man toss a yellow trash bag into a bin behind a laundromat. Normally, someone throwing a trash bag into a garbage bin wouldn't seem out of the ordinary. But for some reason, something about it didn't sit right with the witness. So he called the owner of the laundromat, who came down to open up the bag. Inside was a purse, but it was burned, saturated with gasoline, as if someone tried to destroy it. When he emptied it out, he found partially charred IDs belonging to Nicholas Travis and Tabitha Brewer. After calling police about what they'd found, Tabitha's parents positively identified the purse as belonging to their daughter. Disturbingly, jewelry Tabitha usually wore was also inside the purse, along with Nicholas's checkbook. Police knew it wasn't a good sign, and it certainly didn't fit their runaway lovebirds theory. Soon, they turned their full attention to the classmate who'd picked up the couple the night of the 27th, the last known person to have seen them. Through the school's records and follow-up interviews, detectives were able to identify the pickup driver as Brandon Howell, an 18-year-old from Merriam, Kansas. It was a familiar name to law enforcement, because as a juvenile, Brandon had already been prosecuted for a litany of offenses, ranging from theft to aggravated battery. He'd also spent time in the state youth center for cutting another teenager with a knife. When detectives spoke to Brandon on the 27th, he told them he'd dropped Nicholas and Tabitha off at the Circle K gas station just a mile or so down the road near the interstate. What happened to them after that, he said he had no idea. But when a search was done on Brandon's car, investigators found scuff marks that appeared to have come from a shoe on the underside of the trunk's lid. And when detectives pressed Brandon further about it, he suddenly asked for his attorney. And that was it. The conversation was over. By May 12th, police issued a press release stating they officially suspected foul play in the disappearance of the couple. Later that month, Nicholas's parents spoke to the press saying, "We know they are together wherever they are. We believe Nick and Tabitha are still alive." But after another month passed, Tabitha's mother Brenda stated, "I believe my daughter is dead, so if anyone sees or hears anything, please call." A devastating realization no parent should ever be forced to accept.
I think a lot of us have had moments where we know something feels off, but we're not really sure what kind of help we need. Maybe it's anxiety that isn't letting up, trouble focusing, depression. And sometimes talking things through is helpful, but there are also situations where you may need psychiatric care too. Someone who can actually evaluate what's going on and prescribe medication if it's appropriate. That's where Talkiatry comes in. 100% online psychiatric practice that provides comprehensive evaluations, diagnosis, and ongoing medication management for conditions like ADHD, anxiety, depression, and more. Through Talkiatry, you'll meet with a licensed medical provider who takes the time to understand what's going on. They'll build a personalized treatment plan for you and continue supporting you over time. And access matters too. Talkiatry has more than 800 in-network clinicians with major insurers, so you can use your existing insurance rather than automatically having to pay a monthly subscription or out-of-network costs. All you need to do is complete a short online assessment, get matched with clinicians who fit your needs, and then schedule your first visit in days, not months. And because you continue with the same provider, you're not starting from scratch every time, and your treatment can evolve with you over time. More than 300,000 patients have already found high-quality psychiatric care through Talkiatry. Head to talkiatry.com/madness to complete the short assessment and get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes. That's talkiatry.com/madness to get matched in minutes. talkiatry.com/madness. We've also provided a link in our show notes.
Tabitha's father, Tom, was growing increasingly frustrated by a police investigation that seemed to be getting nowhere. He called every friend, classmate, and acquaintance of his daughter, asking questions, pushing for details. He even spoke to Brandon Howell himself, twice. During his first conversation with them, Brandon gave a different story than the one he'd given to police. In this version, Brandon said he'd taken the teens to the Circle K that night, but then dropped them off at the apartment. During the second conversation, he insisted he'd dropped them off at the gas station and never saw them again. So which story was it? On August 14, 1998, nearly 4 months after Tabitha and Nicholas disappeared, a construction worker was getting ready to pour a concrete patio behind a vacant duplex in Kansas City. It had sat empty for the past 5 years, but a new buyer was hoping to move into it with her mother later that summer. But as the worker started digging around the house, only about 6 inches deep, his pick struck something unexpected. As he brushed away the dirt, suddenly, a man's shoe became uncovered, and to his horror, that shoe was still attached to a human leg. Immediately, the digger called police, who arrived and spent the rest of the day carefully excavating the site. By nightfall, they'd unearthed the rest of the body from its shallow grave, but it was too decomposed to determine race, gender, or age. The location was meaningful, though, because the duplex where the body was found was only 4 houses away from where Tabitha's charred purse was discovered back in April. By Monday, August 18th, police confirmed what the families had been dreading. The body was Nicholas Travis. But no matter how much they dug or sifted through soil, they found absolutely no trace of Tabitha. An autopsy would later reveal that Nicholas had several fractures on the back of his skull, with blunt force trauma determined as the cause of death, manner of death, homicide. Inside the duplex, Luminol revealed a series of blood smears. DNA testing confirmed they belonged to Nicholas. Speaking to reporters after the tragic discovery, Tom Brewer stated, "I don't think I could ever give up hope that she is alive, But knowing Nick and knowing Tabitha and knowing how close they are, I feel that whatever happened to Nick happened to Tabitha. The location of the body provided law enforcement with another clue into the disappearance and now murder. City construction records revealed all the builders who'd filed permits to renovate the duplex over the past year, and one name stood out like a sore thumb. Brandon Howell's father, who'd been hired to repair the roof and raise a ceiling. He was a personal friend of the new owner, who told police that Brandon would sometimes help his father on projects, but didn't know if he worked on her duplex or not. Brandon was the last person seen with Nicholas and Tabitha. Nicholas's body was found buried at a property his father was renovating, a yard that was less than 50 yards away from the trash bin where Tabitha's charred purse had been dumped back in April. A few days later, Brandon was found and arrested on a charge of underage drinking. While in custody, he was also charged for a separate violent incident earlier that year, when he broke another teenager's wrist with a baseball bat and tried shooting him with a handgun. Despite all of this, police and prosecutors still didn't think they had enough to charge Brandon with any crimes relating to Tabitha or Nicholas. Eventually, the assault charges against Brandon were dropped when witnesses refused to cooperate, which meant Brandon was back on the street again, seemingly determined to continue his streak of violence. It was shortly after midnight on October 6, 1999, when three armed men forced their way into an apartment in Gardner, Kansas. One of them was Brandon. They were looking for a man who allegedly owed them money from a drug debt, but he wasn't there. Instead, they found two women and an infant, so Brandon and his fellow gunmen decided to hold the women and the baby hostage until the man they were looking for came home. That man came home a few hours later, and when he did, he was attacked and cut with a large kitchen knife. Somehow, during the fracas, everyone, including the hostages, all managed to escape without further harm. But before Brandon and his friends left the apartment, they delivered a final, deeply disturbing message. The resident's cat, an orange tabby named Tony, was killed, and its remains were left behind in a deliberate and disturbing display. 4 months later, Brandon was identified and charged for his role in the attack. The now 20-year-old pleaded guilty to aggravated kidnapping, aggravated assault, attempted aggravated robbery, and cruelty to animals. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison. For Kansas City law enforcement, the murder of Nicholas Travis and the disappearance of Tabitha Brewer remained open, but cold. But their families never stopped pushing for answers. Then in 2001, Detective Everett Babcock took over the case, and for the next 5 years, he worked it relentlessly, tracking down old witnesses, re-interviewing people who were just kids back in 1998, many who hadn't wanted to talk the first time around. But by the end of it, Babcock had conducted more than 100 interviews and built a case file nearly 1,000 pages long. It was in 2006 that he managed to convince Jackson County prosecutors to file murder charges against Brandon Howell, who at the time was already serving a 12-year sentence. One new witness told investigators that on the night Tabitha and Nicholas disappeared, he had been outside the duplex where Nicholas's body would later be found. He said he heard Tabitha's voice coming from inside. Then, moments later, he heard a man and woman screaming before seeing Brandon walk out with blood on his shirt. Another witness came forward with something just as disturbing. saying that only days before the disappearance, Brandon had described a plan to lure a young couple with money, hold one hostage, while forcing the other to take out cash, then kill them both. The second witness backed that up, saying Brandon had actually tried recruiting him to take part. So why had he chosen Tabitha and Nicholas? Not long before Tabitha disappeared, she'd received a $40,000 settlement from a serious car accident, but the money was locked in a trust, something she couldn't access yet. If Brandon had heard about it, he likely didn't know that part. And then there was one more account. A woman told Detective Babcock that Brandon had once threatened her, saying, "I'll do you like I did Tabitha." In March 2009, Brandon went on trial for the murders of Nicholas and Tabitha, where prosecutors laid out their circumstantial case. The blood in the duplex and its connection to Brandon's father, the burnt purse found practically next door, the witness accounts of threats and plans, and the scuff marks found on the inside of Brandon's trunk. The prosecution even presented a jailhouse informant who testified Brandon had confessed the murders to him. But the defense was able to cast significant doubt on many of the witnesses, arguing they were only testifying so they could cut deals for their own legal problems. The investigation itself was also called into question, with the defense arguing that the families had interfered by speaking to witnesses on their own. In the end, the defense called no witnesses, presented no evidence, and Brandon didn't testify. And yet, after just 5 hours of deliberation, the jury returned not guilty verdicts, leaving the family stunned, devastated, and convinced the jury got it wrong.
Have you ever caught yourself thinking, "I'll start after the weekend. I'll get serious starting Monday. By summer, I'll finally be where I want to be." Then summer arrives before you know it, and you've tried everything to lose weight and still feel stuck. Well, this summer can be different. Weight Loss by Hers is designed to support you in reaching your weight loss goals with access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, you can lose up to 20% of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. Wegovy at Hers helps regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first ever GLP-1 pill for weight loss, so there's no needles required. And everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll get connected with a licensed provider who'll determine if treatment is right for you. And if prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/madness to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/madness. forhers.com/madness. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. We've also provided a link in our show notes.
After the not guilty verdicts, Brandon returned to prison to serve out the rest of his sentence for the 1999 armed invasion in Gardner. And in February 2011, Brandon Howell was paroled. After being transferred to Missouri, where he had strong family support, it looked like Brandon might be turning things around. His early years in prison had been anything but stable. Fights, battery charges, contraband, disobeying orders, 17 disciplinary write-ups in all. But after 2009, that pattern stopped. He had just one minor infraction, so when he was granted parole in 2011, his family believed the worst was behind him. Brandon returned to Kansas City, where he moved in with relatives. And for the next 3.5 years, he stayed out of trouble. He found work in construction and kept his head down. But then one day, Brandon was injured on a job site, and when he told his employer he couldn't come in the next day, he was laid off. Just like that, he was out of work. And whatever thin thread had been holding him on the straight and narrow finally snapped. It was September 2nd, 2014, the day after Labor Day. Charles Shukrin was at work in his beauty salon in Prairie Village, about 7 miles south of Kansas City. That day, he was expecting a very important customer. His wife, 69-year-old Susan Shukrin, had an appointment scheduled with him that afternoon, but she never arrived. After calling Susan a few times and not hearing from her, Charles eventually decided to close up shop and drive home to check on her. Shockingly, as he pulled into his neighborhood on Woodbridge Lane, he found the entire area swarming with police and draped with yellow crime scene tape. When he approached an officer and asked if he could drive to his house, the officer asked for his address. But when Charles gave it, a haunting look came on the officer's face. After getting his supervisor, the news he received was devastating. Susan had spent 40 years as a teacher, specializing in gifted education and Montessori methods. She held a master's degree and taught Sunday school at her local synagogue. But now, she was dead, shot to death outside her home, a victim of an unspeakable massacre that had unfolded earlier that afternoon. It was just before 1 p.m. when police received a desperate 911 call from a female. The only words she spoke before the call was disconnected were, "Help at 1 East Woodbridge Lane, shotgun." Minutes later, officers arrived at the quiet tree-lined cul-de-sac. There, they found Susan lying in her driveway, fatally wounded by a gunshot blast. Next door was the source of the 911 call, the home of an elderly couple. 80-year-old George Taylor and his wife, 86-year-old Anna Taylor. They'd been married for 47 years. George was a Korean War veteran, a brick mason, and a classic car enthusiast. Anna had worked as a court clerk and later ran an antique shop called The Cottage. It was Anna who called 911 that afternoon, and when police entered their home, they found the couple lying motionless down in their basement. Both had suffered severe injuries and were still alive, but barely. As officers continued their search of the cul-de-sac, the couple was rushed to the hospital, but the carnage was far from over. Over at another house along the street, they found two more victims in the driveway, 88-year-old Lorraine Hurst and her 63-year-old son, Daryl Hurst. Both had been killed by gunshot blasts. A spent 12-gauge shell lay nearby. Daryl had worked at General Motors for 32 years before retiring in 2004 and had been married to his wife Kathy for 40 years. He also made a point to spend time with his mother Lorraine, whom he adored. That day, they'd gone grocery shopping together. The scene suggested they were attacked as soon as they returned home. In a space of only a few minutes, five people had been brutally massacred in a cul-de-sac that had only ever known peace, tranquility, and neighborly bonds. Police fanned out across the neighborhood, going door to door, in some cases breaking doors down, searching for the shooter. But they found no one. He was already gone. What they did find were shaken, terrified neighbors who'd witnessed fragments of the carnage from behind their curtains and through their windows. One neighbor told detectives he'd been watching TV when he heard two loud bangs in rapid succession. When he looked outside, he said he saw the Taylor's tan Toyota Highlander SUV turning around in the dead end. Then he heard a third bang. Another witness reported seeing the Taylor's Highlander pull up in the front of Susan Shukran's home. Then they said they saw an African-American male in a black hooded sweatshirt step out of the vehicle and shoot Susan in her driveway before getting back in and speeding away. From the witness accounts, the physical evidence, and the condition of the crime scenes, investigators began to piece together a theory of what had happened. The massacre appeared to have started inside the Taylor's home. George and Ann owned a classic Jaguar that the perpetrator had been trying to steal, but he couldn't get it started. When confronted by the elderly couple, the man attacked them and stole the keys to their Toyota Highlander instead. But the commotion hadn't gone unnoticed. Detectives believed Susan had come out of her home to help her next-door neighbors when she ran into the gunman. Likewise, they believed that Lorene and Daryl Hurst had simply returned from grocery shopping at the wrong time and had accidentally come face-to-face with their killer. Based on this information, a bolo went out for the stolen Toyota Highlander. At 4 p.m., it was found parked miles away at a restaurant in North Kansas City, but the killer was already in the wind. Approximately 10 minutes before the Highlander was discovered, officers had been dispatched to a Motel 6 in the same Northland area on what they believed was an unrelated call. When they arrived, they learned that three people had been violently assaulted just minutes earlier by an unknown individual. Two victims had been walking outside the motel when an African-American male approached them, asking them to bum a smoke. But as they opened the door, the man forced his way inside the room, closing the door behind him, and began viciously beating them. The two victims were able to escape and ran out of the room, but he chased after them. As they fled, a woman from a nearby room stepped outside and was immediately punched in the face before the attacker jumped a fence and disappeared into the night. And for the next 7 hours, he remained at large. Just before midnight, police received a call from a motorist on Interstate 29 reporting that he'd seen a suspicious-looking person walking along the side of the highway. Officer James Mulbauer was already on patrol near the area. As he stood over to investigate, he spotted a man walking on the shoulder. Something about the way he was moving caught his attention. He wasn't walking normally. His right leg stayed stiff, almost dragging slightly. One hand hung low at his side, pressing tightly against his pant leg, like he was holding something in place. Mulbauer stopped and ordered him to the ground. The man lowered himself awkwardly, dropping onto one knee while keeping the other leg stretched out. He said it was just cramps, but when the officer moved to frisk him, the reason became clear. Hidden along the inside of his pant leg was a loaded 12-gauge shotgun. In the man's pockets, Officer Mulbauer discovered two spent shotgun shells and a set of car keys. And there, on the side of the interstate, Brandon Howell, now 34 years old, was taken into custody. He was later charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder. When Tom Brewer, the man who'd spent the past 16 years still searching for his daughter, saw Brandon's face on the news, he said, "I feel sorry for the jurors who acquitted him the last time, because that is going to be hard for them to live with." KMBC9 would later report the connection between the Woodbridge Lane murders and the case of Nicholas Travis and Tabitha Brewer.
And tonight, KMBC9 News is uncovering much more about Howell's lengthy record and violent history, from a disturbing crime to a well-known unsolved murder mystery.
Well, guys, it seems the more people hear about Brandon Howell's past, especially understandably around here, the angrier they get. His name is a familiar one with police, prosecutors, and on jail logs. Howell was arrested last night and charged with yesterday's triple murder in South Kansas City and separate assaults at a Motel 6 in the Northland.
This police department was going to capture this individual. Time was against him.
In 1999, he was convicted of aggravated kidnapping and a host of other charges, including beheading the victim's cat. That is not all. Howell was also charged, but acquitted, in the 1998 deaths of Nicholas Travis and Tabitha Brewer. Howell now faces 12 new charges, with the DA's pledge to finally lock Howell up for good.
This was an individual who committed heinous acts, and he is going to pay for his acts.
Now, among those hoping that he will pay is Tabitha Brewer's mom. That investigation remains unsolved. She told me tonight she is very upset that the prayers go out to these other victims' family, a mom who unfortunately can share their pain.
I think one of the biggest mistakes we make when we have an idea is convincing ourselves we need to have everything figured out before we actually do anything with it. I definitely didn't have everything figured out when I started the Minds of Madness. I learned as I went, made plenty of mistakes along the way, and figured out what worked and what didn't. The important thing was, I started. And if the idea you've been thinking about is starting your own business, Shopify takes a lot of those things you might be worried about figuring out and makes them a whole lot easier. Their templates and AI tools make it easy to build a professional-looking storefront without having to know how to code or hire a designer. You can focus on your product instead of spending weeks trying to figure out a website. And if you've ever bought something online and seen that purple Shop Pay button, you already know how easy it makes checkout. Having your information saved means you can complete your purchase with just a couple clicks, which is great for customers and even better for businesses because more people actually complete their orders. And if you ever get stuck, Shopify also has Sidekick built right into the platform. It's their AI assistant that can answer questions, help you troubleshoot, and keep you moving without wasting time searching for answers. Starting a business is a big deal, and what's going to surprise you is how simpler Shopify makes it. All the tools you need to launch are already included and ready from day one. All you need is the idea. Shopify handles the rest. If you're serious about hearing your first, start your free trial at shopify.com/madness today. You heard that right. Start your free trial today at shopify.com/madness. That's shopify.com/madness. Brandon Howell's trial began at the beginning of April 2019. KCTV 5 News was in the courthouse to cover it.
It's been a long day here at the Jackson County Courthouse, and no cameras were allowed inside for Brandon Howell's trial, but I can tell you that it was a packed house. There was not an empty seat as family and friends of the victim sat and listened in the courtroom today. Prosecutors have the burden of proving their case. Family members and neighbors of the victims, police, paramedics, and investigators from the crime lab were all called to testify. More than a dozen witnesses in all. Brandon Howell is charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder and faces the death penalty. Now, as I just walked out of the courtroom about 30 minutes ago, the last witness was on the stand, and the court clerk told me they blocked off about 2 weeks for this trial, but it could be settled before then. Live in Kansas City, Kelly Taylor, KCTV 5 News.
The case against Brandon for the Woodbridge Lane massacre was overwhelming. The shell casings found in his pocket matched the ones recovered from the Hearst driveway, all fired from the shotgun he was arrested with. The car keys he was carrying belonged to the Toyota Highlander taken from George and Anna Taylor. Forensic teams matched his shoes to the prints found inside the Taylor's garage, and inside the Highlander, they found Susan's blood on the driver's side floorboard. This wasn't circumstantial. It was direct, physical evidence, backed by eyewitnesses who could identify Brandon as the person responsible. There was no ambiguity, no reasonable doubt, and the jury needed less than 2 hours to reach a unanimous guilty verdict. The following month, Brandon was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker later told the Kansas City Star what the verdict meant to the families of the victims.
You know, I met these families, some of them, all those years ago at the other side of the yellow tape, and some the next morning and some within a week, you know, after the Taylors were removed from life support and succumbed to their injuries. So, you know, it's been a long road with them. And they, I guess the thought was just how much damage one person could do to so many people. So I'm just really struck by behind the doors here is a sizable group of people with broken hearts, but at least they know justice is there for them.
Today, Brandon Howell is 46 years old. Beginning from his time in juvenile detention center as a teenager, he's already spent about half of his entire life behind bars. Only 5 years as an adult were spent as a free man in society. But during that time, his path of destruction was staggering. Officially, Brandon is guilty of murdering 5 people on a quiet cul-de-sac, families senselessly ripped apart, and a once peaceful community shattered in its wake. But for many who have followed this case from the beginning, the full toll of Brandon Howell's violence didn't start on that cul-de-sac. It started 16 years earlier, on the night of April 27, 1998. A jury acquitted Brandon of the murders of Nicholas Travis and Tabitha Brewer, and that verdict stands. Under the law, he's not guilty of those crimes. But that was no consolation to the surviving neighbors of East Woodbridge Lane. One resident, 88-year-old Burdette Stewart, told the Kansas City Star, "There's no excuse for this. This never should have happened. I'm sick and tired." When the former DA who prosecuted the violent Gardner home invasion was interviewed, he stated, "My first thought when I heard about this was whether we could have done something different. And mainly I thought, I was glad I could get 13 years out of this guy." One of those hostage victims from 1999 expressed a frustration to KSHB Action News.
"I was appalled. I was disgusted. I couldn't believe it. I didn't understand why he had got out in the first place. This could have been 100% avoided, totally avoided. There's no reason why any more people had to go and have their lives affected or have their lives taken by this man. He's psychotic. And the blink of an eye, he had me by the throat with the guns to my head."
After the quintuple homicide in September 2014, the overwhelming census among the community members was that the Jackson County jury in 2009 had let a guilty and dangerous career criminal go free. And the price of that decision was ultimately paid by the suffering of more innocent lives later on. In February 2023, Officer James Mulbauer, who heroically arrested Brandon on the side of Interstate 29, was killed in the line of duty. A driver ran a red light and struck his patrol car. His canine partner, Champ, and a pedestrian were also killed in the crash. In an instant, another life was lost to tragedy. A husband, a father. His name now stands among the fallen on the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial in Washington, D.C.
This episode of the Minds of Madness True Crime Stories is brought to you by Squarespace. Stories of difficult choices and consequences can lead to reflection. A clear online presence helps a small business stay focused. Squarespace gives you customizable websites, invoices, online payments, appointment scheduling, and email marketing tools in one place. Start with Blueprint AI or a template, then shape the site to fit the brand. Built-in analytics show where visitors come from, what they engage with, and how sales are tracking. Email campaigns helps keep clients informed with templates and automations. Whether services, products, or appointments are the focus, these tools help turn attention into action. Head to squarespace.com/launch for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code LAUNC to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Today, the case of Nicholas Travis and Tabitha Brewer is still officially open. No other suspects have ever been named. No other persons of interest have ever been identified. Despite his acquittal, Brandon Howell remains the only person law enforcement has ever publicly connected to their disappearance and murder. Among the detectives, the prosecutors, the families who lived through it, the case is considered solved. It was simply never proven in court. Nicholas was only 18 when he was murdered and buried in a shallow grave. And Tabitha has never been found, still classified as an endangered missing person. Today, she would be 44 years old. Her mother spent years waiting for a phone call that never came. Her father spent years knocking on doors, searching for answers no one would give. Eventually, Tom Brewer said he forgave Brandon Howell, not because he wanted to, but because the alternative was letting the anger consume what was left of his life. Back in 2001, when Detective Everett Babcock first reopened the case, he was able to track down witnesses who'd been just teenagers themselves in 1998, kids who didn't trust the police at the time, didn't know what to say, or who had simply been too afraid to come forward. Years later, as adults, many of them talked. It happened once, it could happen again. Twenty-eight years have passed since Tabitha vanished. There's always a possibility that someone, somewhere, knows more than they've ever said. A detail dismissed at the time, a conversation overheard, or a secret carried for decades. For two families that have lived nearly 30 years without answers, that could change everything. If you have any information about the murder of Nicholas Travis and the disappearance of Tabitha Brewer, please contact the Kansas City Police Department. Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to early release and ad-free episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe in Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to watch our Thursday release episodes between the madness, you can find them on YouTube and Spotify. To find us on all social media platforms, search The Minds of Madness. And finally, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.
I'm a sinner, I've done bad things. Left scars where love should sing. I hurt people, I break dreams. I'm the shadow tearing at the seams. I wear a smile, but it's a disguise. Ordinary people do unthinkable lies. Minds of madness, twist and turn. Hearts on fire, let them burn. I'll seduce you, take it all. Watch you crumble, watch you fall. Minds of madness, whisper sweet.